Thank you. To set the tone for the meeting, I will read an extract from chapter 7, page 89, Working with Others. Working with others. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure immunity from drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. It works when other activities fail. This is our 12th suggestion. Carry this message to other alcoholics. You can help when no one else can. You can secure their confidence when others fail. Remember, they are very ill. Life will take on new meaning, to watch people recover, to see them help others, to watch loneliness vanish, to see a fellowship grow up about you, to have a host of friends. This is an experience you must not miss. We know you will not want to miss it. Frequent contact with newcomers and with each other is the bright spot of our lives. The topic of tonight's meeting is working step four with a sponsee. And Tim will share anything between 30 and 45 minutes on the topic, and after which the floor will be open for questions rather than the typical sharing. And with that, I will now hand over to Tim.
Thank you. My name's Tim. I'm an alcoholic. Let me just, I'm trying to share the screen. It looks different than usual. Here we go. Let's see if that seems to have worked. There we go. There we go. Can you see the big book now? Yeah, good. Okay, so there are a couple of you I'm not sure I know. So just so you know what this is about, Tim alcoholic, got sober 24th of July 1993. I don't know if I'm a good sponsor, but I'm a busy sponsor. So that bit certainly true. I've done a lot of it. It's rather like with addiction, just because you've done a lot of it doesn't mean you're good at it, but you do have some experience back there. So this is just my personal experience. I don't speak on behalf of AA. If it's helpful, great. If it's not, then don't come back and tell everyone how awful I am. That's just fine with me. So next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action. So I mean, you will already have said this to the sponsee, that they need to, when taking step three, be prepared for concerted action until it's done, until steps 4 through 9 are done. And I would liken it to taking a trip through a sort of dark medieval German forest. As long as you stick, has to be German, doesn't it? You need the menace. Without it being German, there's no French forest, you know, that's pleasant in some, but a German forest. You get the idea. Dangers on every side. You want to stick to the path and get through it as quickly as possible. The path is torchlit, so you're fine. Like, the wolves won't get you as long as you stay on the path. But if you dawdle, you're going to start looking into the darkness, and then the darkness will start to look back at you. And then you'll start to exchange with the darkness. So you want to just get on with it. And what they usually say on big book things is you can't launch slowly. You know, it's got to slip down the slipway into the sea. If it stops, it's really stuck then. The first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us had never attempted. Though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once another indication about the urgency, followed by a strenuous effort to face. Strenuous. What does that mean in practice? If someone is working or has children or has other intense obligations, I think an hour a day on non-working days and 2 hours a day at weekend is pretty reasonable. Get it out of the way first thing in the morning, and then you spend the whole day smugly telling people, I've done my step work already. If you leave it till the evening, you spend all day wondering if you're even going to get it done. And then one day builds up when you haven't done it, and then 2 days and then 3 days, then you can't call your sponsor and you can't go to meetings because you now hate everyone, because you hate yourself, but you're now in denial about hating yourself, so you have to hate everyone else as a diversionary tactic to avoid facing the truth. So rather than that, just get them to do it, you know, get up at 6:30, get it done, and then spend the rest of the day smug. if someone's not working, like, knock yourself out. The one thing I would say, there is such thing as too much step work. Sometimes it gets too intense and you just need to go and do something nice instead. So I tell people to bookend the step work with a little prayer to start with, a little prayer at the end. And maybe if, especially if it's really intense, some people's histories are really intense, to book something nice afterwards to, you know, take the sort of bitterness away and to come back into the room. Strenuous effort. We're not interested in results here. We're interested in effort, and that's important. This is our first attempt to look at this properly, and it's not going to be perfect. So sometimes people spend years doing their first step for, and I don't think that's the most helpful thing to do. You want to get it done. As my old sponsor, Brian, said about his amends, about some of his amends, I think it was his amends or something. He said, I did them. I wouldn't give you tuppence for how I did them, but I did them. And I think it's like that with the first step four, or even the second step. But maybe the first five step fours are a complete disaster, but at least you're getting the material out as best you can. Kevin used to say, you're only interested in the hold luggage. You can come back for the hand luggage later. And I think that's right. A strenuous effort to face and be rid of. So sometimes people talk about, you know, managing anxiety and depression and all of these other things. And that just makes me want to jump off a bridge. Now, my anxiety, my depression, my this, my that did not go straight away. But I want a solution which is going to get rid of it, not just help me somehow live in hell. That's not the purpose. The purpose is to be rid of this crap. The advice I give to sponsees as well about Don Pritz would say that in step four, what you want to do, it's like you're sending a kid to a room to clean up the room by taking a big bin bag and putting all the stuff they don't want and that is broken and doesn't work and they're tired of and they've outgrown. Put it in the bin bag and then we'll take it to the tip and then we'll buy you some new stuff. And that's the image here. Everything we find, we get to get rid of. So we're not finding who we are. This is not about us. It doesn't say we find who we are. We find the things in ourselves which have been blocking us. Now, if you get rid of what's blocking you, you find who you are. But the step four is not about us. It's about the things which don't work. What things? Beliefs, thinking, behavior. I didn't come up with my own beliefs, thinking and behavior. They were taught to me by society and by my family and the people around me. And so step four is about finding the things that I borrowed from other people, which don't work, so I can get rid of them. And then I will, who I am is what's left over when everything from step four is gotten rid of. So that's why there's nothing to be frightened of here, because you're not writing about yourself. You're writing about the beliefs, the thinking, the behavior, which have messed you up, and you're not responsible for installing the bad software in yourself in the first place. So you say to the sponsor, I'm sending you to your room to take all the stuff that doesn't work so we can get rid of it so you don't have to look at it again. Okay. It's totally different than thinking that you're having to sort of, do a catalogue of the hell that you live in, so that at least you now understand that the hell that you live in. There's no point in that. I don't know if any of you are old enough to remember. I'm not going to name names. I think I can see a couple. But there was a show that I remember from the 1970s and early 80s called The Generation Game, where the prize round, a conveyor belt would come past with all of the prizes. And you got to concentrate very hard on the conveyor belt. And then afterwards, after the 2 minutes were up, anything that you could recall as having been on the conveyor belt, you got to keep and take home as the prize. And step four is like that, but in reverse. Anything you get to find, you get to get rid of. So you want to find stuff. You don't want to conceal stuff because it's the stuff that's killing you. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. So again, here, we're interested in peeling back the layers of self-justifying, blame-throwing narratives and stories which have coated these tiny little grains of reality until we can find out what really happened, what really went on. It's about finding the truth, getting past the story, peeling it back and getting to the truth. Also, it's about facts, not judgments. So when I discover, I give you an example, because people are very frightened that although it's a moral inventory, it's not a moralistic inventory. So what's a moral inventory? It's an inventory where, for instance, I discover that I am self-centered. Now, that's not with a wagging the finger at me. That's a moral question. Am I self-centered or am I other-centered? It's definitely a question within the domain of morality. That's where it resides. So it's a moral question. But we're not judging. We're saying, what is going on? And what results are we getting from that? I'll give you an example. I was often told as a child, oh, you're so selfish. Selfish, selfish, selfish. And I never liked that. But when someone said to me, well, let's look at this notion that you might be self-centered. For one day, every half hour, at the end of the half hour, you write down what you've been predominantly thinking about for the previous half hour. And come back to me the next day and we'll do a little summary. What have you been thinking about? And it turns out I've been thinking about myself in some aspect for each of those half hours. I've been thinking about these seven areas of self, which we're going to come to. What I thought others thought of me, pride, what I thought about myself, self-esteem, how others were treating me, personal and sex relations, about my financial position, pocketbooks, about my security, the things that I need, and ambitions, the things that I want. Me being self-centered was simply an objective description of what my thought life was centered on, namely me. So it's not a finger wagging thing. It's simply look at the fact and then you say to yourself, how much fun am I having thinking about me all day long? How pleasant is that? Well, it's horrible. Well, OK, I want to get rid of it then. So it's no different than if you've got a radio and it doesn't work. It's not a bad radio. It's not a naughty radio. It's a radio which doesn't work. And it's the same with all of the beliefs, the thinking and the behavior. What's a character defect? It's a belief, a thinking pattern or a behavior pattern, which does not work. It talks in the big book also about our willingness to throw away the gadget, which doesn't work in favor of the new one, which does. Let's have a look. Resentment. Now, the reason we're starting with resentment, the whole phenomenon of resentment is one in which it's basically a great big narrative where I'm the innocent princess in a world full of ghouls and monsters and ogres and threats and perils and wicked stepmothers and wicked witches, and I'm the one being fed the poisoned apples, so woe is me. And it's basically, I won't go into too many details because I don't want to veer into Course in Miracles territory. But basically, that's what resentment is about. It's about establishing an existential position where I'm innocent and the bony finger of retribution is pointed at you, not at me, because I'm trying to get rid of my own guilt and fear. Right. Okay, so resentment. It's this huge diversionary tactic. If I'm going to have a hope in hell's chance of getting to that moral inventory bit of step four, I've got to get rid of resentment. To get rid of resentment, I've got to be willing to get rid of resentment. To be willing to get rid of resentment, I need to do this analysis in the first three columns to understand the insanity of it. Because it's only by looking at the insanity of it that I'm willing to let go of it. In the same way, it was only when I looked at the insanity of the drinking and the other neat behaviors, the compulsive addictions, it was only by looking at the insanity of it that I recognized that I didn't want the insanity anymore. So the step four, here's the boss level tip. Step four, the moral inventory does not start until page 67. The first question in which I identify a moral failing of myself is, what were my mistakes, on page 67. So what the hell is this stuff about resentment? I'm not going to look at me whilst I think there's something wrong with you, whilst your wrongs are filling my entire universe and consciousness. I cannot look at myself. So we've got to get rid of this stuff first. Another very important point about getting rid of resentment. All resentment is the same. And it boils down to this. If this had been different, I would be okay. If this were different, I would be okay. So whether I've got one resentment or 10,000, the underlying structure is the same. What this means is, I don't need to analyze every single resentment in my life. I need a good range to understand its pervasive impact and to really ram home what is going on. But once the lesson has been learned, I do not need to write. I saw a girl once in a meeting. I felt so sorry for it. She had four lever arch files full of papers on resentments, and she'd been writing it for 2 years. She'd fallen out with her sponsor. She was looking for someone to read it to. People were running and hiding. I tried to talk to her, but she didn't want to summarize it. No. She wanted to read out every damn thing. We get very attached to these narratives. So it's very important. I always explain this to sponsees. You must never treat step four as a socially acceptable form of self-absorption. We're here to get a job done and get it done effectively and efficiently so we can move past it. So the first three columns, first of all, what is resentment? Now, resentment, we think of resentment, and it's one of those words, just like craving in physical craving, or obsession in mental obsession, where the meaning of it in the big book is different than the meaning of it in the language generally. It's related, but it's not exactly the same. So resentment in the language generally means a sort of an ongoing self-righteous grievance. But it's very interesting when you look at the language in the big book. By the way, footnote, what is written here was not what the first 100 did. You need to know that. But if you do what Bill wrote down in 1939, you'll discover it 1,000 times more effective than what the first 100 did. So it's some weird miracle which shouldn't work, but it does. Anyway, that's another question. When it talks about resentment, it then talks about we asked ourselves why we were angry. And then it talks about being hurt or threatened, being sore, being burned up. And then it talks about our injuries and being interfered with, where these things have been interfered with. So really, this is going to be a catalogue, not just of grumbling grievances, but basically any situation where I'm either persistently or recurrently upset. where I'm out of whack. It doesn't matter what flavor the out of whackness is. It can be rage. It can be hurt or threatened. It can be self-pity. It can be basically anything which bothers me, because to do the inventory, I've got to be unbothered. Sometimes when people have a crisis, when sponsees have a crisis, the first thing that they want to do is do the inventory, and you can't because you're still upset. You need to get unupset to do the inventory because you're crazy. If you're crazy, you won't see it straight. So you've got to get unupset first. So with this, I get people, and I do this myself, of course, I get people to write about anything which upsets them. It doesn't matter if it feels like the word resentment, just anything which upsets you or bothers you at any level. And first of all, you want people to do a full catalogue of names of people, places, situations, ideas. So when it says principles, treat that as being abstract ideas. So I've had problems with literally the second law of thermodynamics. I'm not going to go into detail, but that took up a couple of years back there. It's possible to have resentments against super abstract things. It doesn't matter. The point is to get something down in the first column. Now, one of the points of that is if you can get a comprehensive first column of all the things which have basically persistently or recurrently bothered you in your life, and it's you're not writing in detail, but you've got a full list. The purpose of this is twofold. First of all, it gives you a starting point for the rest of the step four. But secondly, you now know the scope of everything that is wrong with you. Everything that is wrong with you is sitting behind those situations. I used to go to psychotherapy, and it was wonderful in some ways, but every time I went, it was like cutting the head off the hydra and two more heads grew back. So it didn't matter what we resolved. I seemed to come away from each session with twice as many problems as I started. With this, it's the opposite process, where if you can, I remember looking at a piece of paper with all the names on and saying, my God, my whole life problem can actually be summarized on one page. If I can get past these disturbances, I'll be fine, which I indeed was. Once they've got the list of names, and it could be the most someone had was 670. If people have fewer than 20, I don't believe them. I just don't believe people that have fewer than 20. So that's a whole other discussion. But most people come up with between 20, 50, 60, 70. What I then get people to do is narrow down the top 20 to cover a whole range of areas in their lives. On the basis that once you've analyzed 20, you're not going to learn anything new. Everything is just the same thing wearing a different hat. And then we get to the second column, and look at this. Look how concise it is. Mr. Brown, I'm resentful of Mr. Brown. His attention to my wife, told my wife of my mistress. Brown may get my job at the office. You'll notice one, two, three, five words. One, two, three, six words. One, two, three, four, five, eight words, but no more than that. So I get people to write up to five charges per person, to try to be as factual as possible and not to tell a great big story. We want to get the nub of it in the second column. And to do that for somewhere around 20 people. And that can be done in like 40 minutes. Some people need some real hand-holding to go from the abstract story in their minds to the actual truth of what is going on. And my favorite example, my friend Ivana, I know she doesn't mind me telling the story. She had a problem with Carol. And she, second column, Carol is always putting me down. And I started, and you want to examine this with them. Say, always, what you mean, like literally every time you encounter Carol, she puts you down? No. So how often? Well, it turns out once a week. What do you mean by putting you down? That's a bit abstract. That could mean anything. She said she criticizes my ideas. Okay, that's great. That's now concrete. I can understand that. She criticizes my ideas. Give me a bit of background here. Who is she? Oh, she's my boss. She's 20 years my senior. What's the context in which this is happening? It's work meetings where we get to throw out ideas and then everyone comments on everyone else's ideas. So the truth in the second column was, so we changed the first column from Carol to my line manager. And in the second column, we got it down to occasionally disagrees with me in work meetings. Now, can you see how Carol always puts me down is totally different than my line manager occasionally disagrees with me in work meetings? In getting the facts down in the second column, we're already doing a huge amount to strip away the narrative. Often the narrative sounds like, you know, when they're telling you what's going to happen on a soap opera this evening, that's what people's first draft of the second column sounds like. And I always work very carefully on the second column to strip back the all the fluff, get back down to the facts, because that's just such an important tool for the rest of your life, that when you go off the deep end, to have the ability to immediately start discounting the ego's narratives and just look at something plainly and factually. Now, the effects my, what it says here is effects my, and then it's got these seven areas, which we talked about earlier: pride, what you think about me; self-esteem, what I think about me; personal relations, how you treat me; sex relations, how you treat me in the bedroom, or in related areas; pocketbooks is to do with money; security, what I need; ambitions, what I want. Now, I used to do this the very traditional way, and just people would write, I would write, this affects my personal relations, sex relations, self-esteem, blah, blah, blah. And I don't know if you've ever heard of step five, where that's all someone does for the third column. First of all, within 5 minutes of it starting, you want to start sticking pins in your eyes or their eyes, because it's so boring and painful. And you're like, why? What are you learning from this? I don't know. And that's the problem. It doesn't really tell you anything, unless, here again, boss level tip. Page 67, it says an interesting thing. Where had we been self-seeking? Where had we been self-seeking? Now, when I apply this little trick, which is I took this question, where had I been self-seeking, and I applied it back to these seven areas of self, all the lights went off. And this is the key to getting out of resentment. The reason I'm resentful is because I am self-seeking. In other words, I have a plan, a scheme, a plot, a design, a set of expectations, a blueprint for how I want my life to look. And you're messing with it. Your behavior is not in accordance with my blueprint. Now, whilst my upset is your fault, I'm going to stay unhappy forever. If I'm upset not because of your behavior, but because of my blueprint, we have a way out here, because I can get rid of the blueprint and then I'm going to be okay. So to get rid of resentment, you either eliminate the person, because you can't change them, so you have to eliminate them. You know, wait till they're standing at the top of some stairs, one little push and it's in God's good hands. You can either eliminate them or you can eliminate self. You get to pick. Eliminating other people, and I can tell you it takes a long time. There's a long list of people to get through. Eliminating self, you eliminate self and you solve the problem universally. Rumi, Sufi poet, would say that it is easier to wear slippers than to carpet the whole world. So what we want to do with this third column is use this to demonstrate case by case by case that the reason I'm resentful is because I have a plan. Now, how do you get to the plan? If you say to someone, how are you self-seeking here? They're going to say, I don't know. And they won't, because the ego is desperate to cover its tracks. So what we've got to do, the way I do it now, I've done it differently in the past. The way I do it now is I start with personal relations and sex relations. Personal relations and sex relations are about, I got a script for how I want you to behave. If it's in the sexual domain, it's sex relations. If it's everything else, it's personal relations. And I say, how do we want you to behave? So let's take the example of the line manager. Personal relations. And you go to town, you're giving the ego a voice in order to write down what it says and look at it objectively. So the line manager. What's my script for the line manager? Agree with everything I say in work meetings. There we go. That's the script. Now, the reason why I want someone to behave in a certain way is because I have a plan for what my life should look like. And the plan breaks down into all the financial stuff, which is pocketbooks, into all the needs. A need is something that everyone needs. If it's just you, it's not a need, it's a want. So a need is about basic stuff, which is common to all humanity. That's security. Ambitions is about what I want. So I say, you know, to the now imaginary sponsee, right. So Carol, your boss, if she would always agree with you in work meetings, what would that deliver to you in terms of outcomes? She'd say, well, I'm going to get to keep my job. I put that on security. I keep my job. Pocketbooks. Well, that affects my income. That bounces back onto security. I'll have somewhere to live, somewhere to some funds to pay for my daily necessities. Because if she criticizes me, what I'm frightened of is she's going to sack me. And then ambitions. I want a smooth progression up the career chain. So we've now got a picture of the blueprint for this person's life. And then that's the outset. So you've got scripts, personal and sex relations. You've got the ambition, security and pocketbooks, which is the outcomes. And then you've got the internal crap. So why am I bothered that my line manager criticizes me in work meetings? Because I'm frightened that my colleagues think, this is pride, think I'm incompetent. Incompetent, there we go. It's no more complicated than that. Incompetent and foolish. I want them to think of me as smart, innovative, accomplished. And then self-esteem might be the same thing. So what I get people to write and what I write myself under pride, how do I want them to see me? How do I think they see me? Self-esteem, how would I like to see myself? How do I actually see myself? And sometimes those feed into each other. So if people think I'm crap, I think I'm crap. If I think I'm crap, I'll project that out onto other people. They're not always the same though. Sometimes you know you've done an amazing job, you just can't get the buggers to see it. Sometimes you think you're terrible, even though everyone's saying, oh, we love you so much and you have so much to live for. But you're like, no, I'm the most terrible person in the world. You just won't believe anyone. So sometimes it's just self-esteem. Sometimes it's just pride. Normally it's both. So what you get from this, I get people to summarize the third column across the whole of the step four and say, right, you've now summarized on one page your ego's blueprint for your life. If only this blueprint would be established and maintained in reality, if we could build the building designed by this blueprint, we'd be okay. And you get them to read it out, and they're normally laughing by about a third of the way through, because number one, it's full of contradictions. Number two, it's pie in the sky because it's so improbable. I want everyone to love me and adore me and respect me and validate me and praise me and give me lots of money the whole time with no exceptions. It's just unrealistic. And thirdly, what happens when the plan comes off? Well, I just make up another plan. Which is what happens. You're fine for like 8 minutes and then the cold wind starts to blow and you're back at square one again. It's like peeing yourself in public. There is a moment of relief, but there is no long-term benefit. And what this whole exercise does, it does two things. First of all, it loosens the individual's allegiance to their ego's narrative about what is going on, because it's so clearly insane. But you have to get it. When it's in my head, it seems completely rational. When it's out on paper and then communicated to someone else, it looks totally different. Once we've got that, we look at the page 66. And page 66 is all about motivations for getting rid of resentment. Let's whiz through these. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. So I get people to identify where this is the case. Have you noticed that just because you're upset about your financial situation does not make money fly through your letterbox? It does not achieve what it's meant to achieve. Unhappiness is self-evident. Also, there's the displacement. To the precise extent that we permit these, permit, interesting verb, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But then the ultimate reason is, if I stay resentful, I'm going to drink. If I drink, I'm going to die. Also, there's a bit down here which started to get to me recently. A few years ago, we began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. And what I get to see when I'm taking someone else through this as well is, I'll ask this direct question. Have you noticed that because of this setup with the blueprints, with the scripts, the outcomes, the image that you want to hold of yourself, that what you're doing is you're giving other people the right to determine how you feel? You've become their glove puppet. In fact, the people that you respect the least in the world have the most sway on how you feel. How do you like that? Do you want to be like that? Do you want to be someone that is constantly triggered and set off by ordinary everyday events, or do you want to be free? And honestly, that's the one that gets most people. People often don't care if they drink or not, but they don't like the idea of other people being in charge of how they feel. And that's true for me. Honestly, emotionally, that's the one that I connect to. And now the purpose of all of that, is to start to look at the actual solution. And one of the big things which happens in recovery is people get really good at writing, but not very good at changing. So the purpose of getting this far is to literally change, which means I've got to cut off the resentment at the ankles. Now, people's step fours vary. Sometimes you have step fours where everyone on there is clearly like borderline evil, and that happens, particularly people that get sober really young. One of the reasons they get sober really young is because there were a lot of really bad people when they're growing up. Some other people, it's pretty clear that like people were just people and they were just in my way. So this notion of people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Yet sometimes, or maybe they were just getting on with their lives and they were in my way, and so they were a target. But basically, the simple insight I need to convey at this point with the sponsee is this. If people behave badly, it is because they are driven by emotions that are more powerful than them. Exactly the same as on page 62. about ourselves. So we take the insight from page 62 and apply it here, and to deliberately look at these other people and say, why might they have behaved badly? What might be motivating them? Can I identify with those motivations, even though the manifestation is different? Can I identify with them? And that starts to break down the barrier between me and other people. And then to diligently, over a period of a couple of weeks, apply this prayer. This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God save me from being angry. Thy will be done. Every single time the person pops into your head. Again and again and again. And it's amazing. It works. You can turn other things here into prayers. God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and everyone. And so I turn it into a prayer and say, God, show me how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and everyone. And a good way of doing that, the trick I give people is ask God to show you what the world looks like through their eyes. And it's not fun, that one, but it's helpful. And within 8 seconds, I realize, oh my God, I'm a complete monster. Or I've been behaving like a complete monster. I'm a perfect child of God, but I've been behaving like a monster. There we go. I also send people a bunch of readings and things to watch about resentment and forgiveness and all of that. So you can go to town on that forgiveness stuff. And that forgiveness journey then carries on forever on its own track. You're never done with forgiveness. People say we're in forgiveness school here. That's what the planet is. It's forgiveness school. And the lessons don't stop coming. And then finally, we're doing an inventory. And I'm going to finish in 3 minutes, Alistair. There are 8 questions here. I see 8 questions. People disagree. People can't. You know, people can't agree on how to count things in AA. Is it twofold or is it threefold? Well, I don't know. Let's count the folds. They keep moving, though, don't they? But I see 8 questions here. Putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done. That's what the whole last 3 pages are about. We resolutely look for our own mistakes. With mistakes, I'm looking at, Where is my perception of this situation been wrong? What did I do that I shouldn't have done? What did I not do that I should have done? But the perception has to be altered. And I get a bit kind of Rottweiler, Vulcan, cross-examining barrister with this stuff about the perceptions. If you're not that sort of person, get them to talk to a friend in AA who is a bit like that. I need from the people around me absolute brutality about deconstructing my little fanciful narratives about things and challenging my perception of things. If my perception doesn't change, I am screwed. You want people to challenge you. So the first question, what are my mistakes? Where is my perception distorted? What is the true story here? What is the sane way of looking at this? Then these questions are now super straightforward. The hard bit we've done, which is getting behind the resentment. This is the easy bit. Where was I selfish? That's where I put my interests ahead of yours. What are your interests that I've disregarded? Dishonesty. That straightforward lying, misrepresentation, concealment, or delusion. Self-seeking. We've already basically covered self-seeking by those extra questions about the third column. What was I frightened of? Brainstorm bullet points. Where were we to blame? That's where I'm looking at the situation. What specific contribution did I make to that situation which made a bad situation, which either created the bad situation or made a bad situation worse? We saw our faults. The 7th question is faults, character defects. I give people a list of character defects. Some people like a list of 20. other people want the list with like 300, like whatever suits the person's personality, give them the range, let them pick. But I don't write more than three faults per personal situation, because otherwise you're just there forever. You want to pick the main items. And then finally, we admitted our wrongs. That's the behavior of mine that harmed other people. So the seventh question, faults, prepares me for step seven. The eighth question, wrongs, prepares me for step eight. Now, what do I write these questions about? Number one, I write them about the 20 people that I did the detailed analysis of in the third column, plus any other area of my life. So often food, finance, looking after your home. There are lots of areas which won't necessarily come up in the resentment inventory, but this is a moral inventory of my whole life. And I tell you, I've had people where the resentments cover like 1/10 of their life, but the real problems are over there. There's a gambling problem. There's a food problem. There's a diet problem. There's an exercise problem. There's a caffeine problem. There's an energy drink problem. There's a someone going to psychics and spending £400 a month with like those like sky psychics, phone lines, all sorts of weird stuff that will not come out of the woodwork unless you say, honey, you want to look at your whole life, not just the people you resent, because that's where the inventory lies. We'll cover fear and sex, both distasteful subjects, next week, but I'm going to stop there for now and ask Alistair if you would to open it up for questions.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you very much. That's very helpful. The meeting is now open for questions for Tim, which can be done by raised hand function in Zoom, or you can message me through the chat function and I will ask Tim directly. If all else fails, just wave at me violently on the screen and I'll hand it over to you to ask your question. And we'll try and close on the hour. Well, we might be a little bit longer. Anyway, any questions? Amara, you have a question, and then Karen.
Okay, thank you. Tim, I was wondering, for the fear part in the fourth column, do you encourage your the people you're working with to go back to the third column and to connect all the fears that arise out of the like demands from the seven areas of self?
That's a good question. I don't find people have a problem with that question usually. I think it usually works out in a very straightforward way. So what I get people to look at, well, first of all, there are two sources of the fear question. First of all, it's those relationships. Secondly, it's those the areas of life not covered by resentment. And I just get people to, and this is all I do myself, is to imagine myself in that situation and say, well, what fears are floating around in my mind when I consider that situation? I find things just float to the surface pretty naturally. It's not an analytical exercise. It's being sensitive to what is going on inside. It's little fears which are like crawling around under the carpet. It's lifting up the carpet, but you can kind of see where they are. So I think it's, you don't get there by analysis, you get there by sensing the bits that you're simply by sensing the fear, which is why you have to be emotionally connected to do the step four, because fear, because the emotions are the way in, which is why any addictive process which is active will put the kibosh on the whole thing, because it stops you from being connected to the emotions, which are the way into the information. Does that answer your question, Amara?
Well, yeah, I was kind of thinking about how fear is in parentheses in the third column.
Yeah.
You know, like, and do you draw the person who you're working with their attention to that at any point, you know, during it, or is it just like whatever's not covered will be covered in the actual fear inventory and you don't make too big of a deal?
I don't make too big a deal of it. I honestly, I don't think I've ever had anyone struggle to come up with the fears. I maybe people who sponsor a lot of very sort of mask straight men may have different experiences, but I mean, I'm, you know, mostly sponsoring the, you know, the ladies and the pansies, so we're all about everything anyway. And the sensitive men, you know, like the ones who are going to have trouble getting in touch with their fear, like I am, that boy, are they going to avoid me. So I'm not the best person to ask about how to wheedle fears out of people, because no, they're in a different room talking about something else.
Thanks, Tim. Karen, you want to say something?
Thank you. And thank you, Alistair, for hosting this meeting. Tim, I don't have a question right now, but I have a comment and a great big thank you. Someone that I am relatively close to, who is always on my fourth step list, that should have been the first clue. You brought something to mind and made it so huge for me. And I just have to give you oodles of gratitude for that. It was like I've been seeing it like as a small ad in a paperback, and it's been blinking. And what you did is you made it this flashing billboard that really got my attention. And I was able to just absolutely, through the way you discussed this and took us through it, was able to see exactly what's going on so clearly that I hadn't been able to see before because I was so involved in the little print. So thank you very much. I'm very grateful for that.
Thanks, Karen. Angus, you had a question then. Sarah Rivka after Angus.
Yeah, thanks. I hope you can hear me. How do you set up the second part of the bit after the resentment you talked about? So like, say I've got a problem, I can't clean my bathroom, or my house is in disarray and that's what I need to do a moral inventory on. How would you set that up? I'm a bit unclear what you'd put down, and then how you'd begin to analyse that.
Right. So with the other areas, first of all, I get people to write a list of areas of your life, categories of relationship, like sponsees, colleagues, family members, neighbors, whatever, and then activities. And some, there may be nothing there, maybe tickety-boo. But others, I think those eight questions are amazing, because basically, if you answered, what are my mistakes, entirely accurately, that would be your entire inventory. But that question doesn't always elicit everything it's intended to, which is why you've got seven more questions to catch it. It's like seven nets to catch the sort of falling debris. So those eight questions, they all come at the same thing from different angles. And I mean, let's take the area. If I just take the area of food, what are my mistakes? I don't know about you, but I know straight away. If you ask me, what are my mistakes around food? I know. What am I frightened of? I know. I'm frightened of being fat and weird looking and ugly. And what am I frightened of? Not having enough. I'm frightened of that if I don't enjoy the food now, there won't be any more later, or I'll spend the rest of the evening unable to concentrate because I won't be full enough. I mean, I'm not quite right around food, as you can tell. But it's not deep below the surface, this stuff. But those eight questions, you get people to answer them as honestly as they can. I think there's an important thing. There's an important thing here. It says somewhere in step four that nothing counted but honesty and thoroughness, which means I get to ask the questions that are there, those eight questions about each area of my life. I get to ask those questions, and then honesty is admitting to myself when something pops into my mind and then writing it down. Sometimes you ask a question and you don't get much in the way of an answer, but whatever you get is enough to be going on with, and you've got the rest of your life to sort out the detail. All you need from this step four is basically a general overview of what is going wrong and enough things to work on for the next 5 years. And I bet if any of us now got a piece of paper and said to our higher powers, what are the 10 things in my life that need to change in beliefs, thinking, or behavior? I bet within 5 minutes we would have enough material to work on for the next 10 years. So there's never any fear about not uncovering enough material to work on. That's not the problem here. I just trust the questions, because I think the questions do the business here.
Thanks, Tim. Sarah Rivka.
Hi, thanks, Tim. And I have a comment and a question. So my comment is that we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. I have heard that that's a rhetorical question, because then it's answered. My mistakes were that I was selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. Okay, so that's a comment. And then my question is, I've experienced two different approaches in terms of sponsorship with the fear. One approach is that the person writes down, I have a fear of spiders. And you say, okay, and you let that go. And then when they get to the fear inventory, they figure that out. And the other approach is to ask why. Why are you afraid of spiders? Well, they might bite me. And then why? But what's the problem with that? Well, then I might die. Because most things boil down to a fear of death, or a fear of being alone, or some abandonment or whatever. Anyway, so I was just wondering if you let people just write, you know, the spider, or if you make them like take that to the logical conclusion.
That's a good point and a good question. On the first point, if you go to 10 different big book studies or 10 different big book groups, each one will do it differently and think that it's got the right way. It's like, you know, all of these weird churches in New England in the 17th century, each one of which thinks it's going to found the New Jerusalem. And the same thing seems to happen in AA. So I think exactly how people construe the book is entirely down to them. I don't think there's a right way or a wrong way. There's the way I'm currently doing things, and that's it. But I think the differences don't make any difference in terms of outcome. I think what makes the difference in terms of outcome is sincerity and speed. If you're sincere and you do it fairly quickly, like my part of it is 1%, 99% of it is God's. So, you know, if the 1% isn't quite right, I think God can handle the rest. On the fear thing, I don't get them to analyze the fears in the fourth column, because we've got the fear inventory to do that whole thing. But you've hit the nail on the head. We asked ourselves why we had them. And I don't want to sort of preempt too much, but basically the two ways of doing that, because you brought it up, I'm going to mention it. The two ways of doing that is, my friend Eamon says, we asked ourselves why we had them. What in my childhood established that as a fearful thing in the first place? That's a very interesting question. Or if this happens, what would happen next? If that happens, what would happen next? So you imagine it like a line of dominoes. The things that you're frightened of on the surface are the first domino. If that first domino falls, what other dominoes fall? And the last domino to fall is the core fear. But honestly, again, ultimately with resentment, it doesn't matter how you analyze it. At some point, you've got to forgive the buggers and get on with your day. And with fear, however you analyze it, at some point, you've got to let go. You can either analyze it for 20 years and then let go, or you can let go now. But the letting go is the same either way. So although I like to do this thoroughly and carefully, I'm always bearing in mind it's really ultimately because this whole process opens a door to God, who then floods through your life and clears out all the crap in ways that you couldn't have analyzed your way towards. I don't know if that makes any sense or helps, but there it is.
Thanks, Tim. We are running a little bit over time. I hope, is that okay, Tim? Yep. Claire, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. Actually, just a quick comment and then a question. I think I was just thinking now, I've never had a sponsee who could accurately pin down what was a fear, but just the very process of asking that question again and again to show that their resentment has to do with fear has almost been enough. But just my question is, if in the second column there is five charges and they seem to be somewhat unrelated to one another, when I'm going through then with the third column, and it's asking those questions, what is the demand and the outcomes, I sometimes get muddled about which charge these subsequent questions are addressing. And
okay, that's a good point. Okay, so sometimes, particularly when it's close relationships like spouses and so on, or work colleagues or flatmates, then there's a whole, pardon my French, a shit show in the second column. If you've got five unrelated scenarios, then you want to look at the third column questions, which of the seven areas were affected and how individually for each one. You don't bundle them together because it makes no sense. Sometimes, particularly with intimate relationships, although that's a sort of bad term, because the so-called intimate relationships are usually the relationships in which there is the least intimacy. There's warfare, but there's no actual intimacy. Anyway, intimate relationships. The second column, sometimes the best way to come at it is to look at the relationship as a whole. And this is actually true with spouses, with siblings, with parents. It's not about the surface situation. It's about this ideal for what the relationship should look like in general. So if you're looking at lots of different practical scenarios, you look at the third column separately for each one. If you're looking at a kind of complex, entangled, intense relationship, and what you got in the second column is just 4 out of 5,000 examples of general kind of crap personal interactions, you really want to leap past that and do the whole third column just on the relationship. You know, ideally, how would I like my mother to behave? If my mother behaved in a certain way, how would that affect my finances? What do I think my mother thinks of me? How would I like my mother to think of me? Just go straight to the nub of it. Does that make sense, Claire?
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Conway, ask a quick question. Have you had a situation with a sponsee where the sponsee is convinced that the resentment itself, or the you know, column one, is at a situation rather than you mentioned situations and the people involved in that situation? Well, he seems convinced that the resentment is at the situation rather than the people.
Yeah, it can happen. I don't worry. I don't get too technical about that. I mean, I had a kind of a funky week last week in various ways. And my I had 8 resentments. And as I counted them, I had 8 resentments, and none of them were against individual people. 4 were against categories of people in society. I'm not going to name names, but we all know who they are. 4 were against categories of people in society. The other 4 were against trends and practices in the industry I work in. So it can't really be like the first column. I can't really pin it down. There isn't like George or Susan or Clive who's doing this thing. It's what matters is, I think, the second column, getting it clear. What is going on in the actual material world which is bothering me? Let's try and reduce that to a few words. Who's behind that in the first column? Who knows? Could be forces of nature. It could be all sorts of things, but it's getting what we're interested in is making a distinction in the second column. What are the events, situations, words, actions in the material world? Third column is all of my internal stuff. And to learn for the first time in your life that there is a distinction between these two things, that they're not all rolled up into one ball, that you can take any emotional upset and divide it into A, the external trigger, and B, my response. So as long as you can accurately describe the situation that is happening out there, even if it's like a group of people or the way an industry operates, that's sufficient. It doesn't need to be boiled down to a name.
Thank you. I don't think there's any more questions. I will start closing up the meeting, actually. Back to the script. Actually, I will post a Google Drive in the chat. This is where the meetings are recorded to, and hopefully you'll find that helpful. And with that, I will hand it back to Tim to close the meeting with the Serenity Prayer.
Thank you. Would you please join me in the Serenity Prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept things I can't change,
courage to change the things I can,
and the wisdom to know the difference.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tim. Thanks, Alistair. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you, Alistair. Thank you, Tim.
Thanks.
Cheers, Tim.
Thank you.
That, Dan, at quarter past, is that all right?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Okay. Yep.
You've got
another meeting starting now.
We actually have to close this one down, and we get together on the on this meeting again. But
yeah. Oh, you need to stop recording.
Oh, yeah.